From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
President Obama commuted the sentence of longtime Puerto Rican independence activist Oscar Lopez Rivera. Who's
in January of 2017, a few weeks before President Obama left office, he commuted the sentence of a man once considered one of the most dangerous revolutionaries in the United States, Oscar Lopez Rivera.
Three people were killed in New York City today and more than 30 injured when a bomb went off.
Today, we go back to the 1970s and tell the story of the battle Oscar Lopez Rivera waged for Puerto Rican independence. From the FBI manhunt.
It was truly the first clandestine terror organization that we confronted, and we had no clue as to how to approach this.
To the campaign for his release.
Basically, every country has a freedom fighter.
That's coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No te vayas. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
You know, for 12 years, I was locked up for 22 hours and 40 minutes.
This is a phone call with a man who was once one of the nation's most famous prisoners. We spoke with him in October of 2016. Before he was arrested, Oscar Lopez Rivera was seen by the FBI as one of the most dangerous revolutionaries at large in the United States. He was caught and convicted of seditious conspiracy, and he served 35 years in prison. So how old are you now, Oscar?
I'm 73 years old.
It's a story that many have forgotten. But in the 1970s, Oscar was part of a group of young, bookish Puerto Ricans who essentially declared war on the most powerful nation in the world. They set off bombs in major American cities and demanded independence for Puerto Rico. After his arrest, thousands of people in Puerto Rico and its diaspora demanded Oscar Lopez Rivera's release from federal prison. Then, in a shocking event, in January of 2017, just a few days before President Obama was set to leave office, the White House made an announcement.
President Obama also commuted the sentence of longtime Puerto Rican independence activist Oscar Lopez Rivera, who's been in prison for 35 years, much of the time in solitary confinement.
Oscar was going to be freed. His supporters were elated.
Chicago's Puerto Rican Cultural Center erupting in joy at the news that Oscar Lopez Rivera will soon be free.
But the commutation was controversial.
So I understand why a lot of people in America are furious by it. But I thought back to our founders and the Boston Tea Party, right, which the British government at the time thought was a terrorist act.
You compare the heroes of the Boston Tea Party to Oscar Lopez Rivera?
Oscar Lopez Rivera has been compared by his supporters to George Washington or Nelson Mandela. But to his opponents, he's an unrepentant terrorist. And today, we're going to spend the whole episode going deep into Oscar Lopez Rivera's story. I'm joined throughout the episode by Latino USA producer Marlon Bishop.
It's a story that reads almost like a spy novel at times. There's secret identities and safe houses. There's an FBI manhunt. There's bomb manuals and revolutionary communiques.
Midtown Manhattan was jolted today by the FALN, a terrorist group calling for the independence of Puerto Rico.
Oscar was a member and, according to the FBI, a leader of the FALN, or the Fuerzas Armadas de Liberación Nacional, the Armed Forces of National Liberation. It was an armed, clandestine group, and it claimed responsibility for more than 70 bombings in American cities between 1974 and 83, with the goal of bringing attention to what they saw as a colonial occupation in Puerto Rico.
The bombs caused millions in property damage, injured dozens, and killed five people.
And at its heart, Oscar's story raises a classic question. Who's a freedom fighter, and who's a terrorist, and who gets to decide?
I And we're going to start, as one does, at the beginning, in the city of Chicago. From the 1940s through the 60s, there was a massive migration to the United States from Puerto Rico, and Oscar's family was part of it.
So your arrival into Chicago, what was that like?
The temperature was below zero, and I was wearing, you know, like regular clothes from Puerto Rico, and I wanted to get back on an airplane and go back to Puerto Rico.
Oscar arrived in Chicago when he was 14. His family settled in a neighborhood called Humboldt Park, where a lot of Puerto Ricans were moving in. And it was tough. Their building was infested with roaches and rats. Their dad left the household, leaving their mom to support a family of six while making a dollar an hour in a factory.
Humboldt Park was this traditionally Eastern European immigrant neighborhood, and they didn't take kindly to the Puerto Ricans who were moving in. Here's Oscar's younger brother, Jose.
The police used to pick up the Puerto Rican kids on the corner, take them to Smith Park, which was in the Italian community, scream Puerto Ricans in the park, leave them there, and they would get beaten.
It was a very traumatic experience, the racism. I was a straight-A student in Puerto Rico. And in Chicago, it was very, very hard for me because of the language. You know, people would make fun, and it wasn't easy, you know.
When Oscar was 18, he got drafted to go to Vietnam. There, he won the Bronze Star for bravery. And Oscar says he would go on these missions in the countryside and encounter Vietnamese people.
I grew up in a farm, so I could really identify with that lifestyle and how terrible it was what we were doing to them.
And so Oscar began to question, what am I doing here?
What is this world all about? You know, and I couldn't find any answers in Vietnam.
At the same time Oscar was in Vietnam, back in Humboldt Park in Chicago, something big had happened. Here's his brother Jose once again.
1966, on the street, the community would experience the largest, boldest, I think, Puerto Rican rebellion in the United States. Most people don't talk about that. In 1966, there would be a whole breakout of violence on this entire street. It's called the Division Street Riots.
The riots started after the very first Puerto Rican parade in Chicago. People were drinking and having fun, and all of a sudden, there was some kind of altercation. The police came in with their guns drawn, and a young man was shot in the leg.
The people immediately, they're very angry. People begin to turn the police cars upside down. The police were beating the people. It turned into a nightmare, and it lasted almost 3 days.
Oscar heard about the riots while he was in Vietnam, and it deeply affected him. His brother remembers Oscar telling him this.
While I'm killing Vietnamese here, police and the National Guard are attacking my people in Chicago. And that really was like the moment that he begins to really change.
Oscar returned to Chicago about 6 months after the riots.
I was the first one to open the door when he came in. He gave me his medal and his uniform and says, I never want to see this again.
The year was 1967.
1967 is a very, very crucial year. For example, it is the year that Dr. Martin Luther King denounces the war in Vietnam.
Have been shot down on the battlefield of Vietnam.
And it's also the year that Muhammad Ali refuses to be drafted.
I will not go 10,000 miles from here to help murder.
And there was a very strong anti-war movement in the city of Chicago.
Revolt was in the air, and Oscar wanted to be part of it. He got a job working as a community organizer. He was setting up protests and sit-ins about the war, and also around issues like housing and education. And he was good at it.
He was just the kind of guy. He was just all over the place, you know? He was leading these struggles. It was so exciting.
Felix Rosa remembers Oscar as being a kind of neighborhood hero.
He had the long hair, you know, with the mustache. He had that green army jacket, you know, and he looks you straight in the eyes. He pierces you, you know, and he listens. That's the main thing. He listens.
Felix was a member of the Latin Dragons, a local Chicago Latino gang, and he found himself drawn to the protests that Oscar was organizing. Oscar would include the Dragons by having them work security at their protests.
You know, he respected us. We never got that from anybody, you know? And that was quite telling for me, you know, about his character, you know?
As Oscar's activism deepened, a newfound sense of pride in being Puerto Rican began to stir in him. His brother Jose explains it this way.
In Puerto Rico, we live a colonial situation, but everybody around you was Puerto Rican. Your doctors, your policemen, everybody was Puerto Rican. Here you came and you didn't see anyone that in any way reminded of who you were. That we came to be Puerto Ricans because we were ostracized. We founded and grounded our humanity in what little we knew about Puerto Rico. Our Puerto Ricanness maintained our humanity.
And some quick background for those that don't know, Puerto Rico has been a territory of the United States since 1898. Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens, but can't vote in federal elections, and they have no voting representation in Congress. And Congress ultimately has complete control of Puerto Rico's affairs.
And that control was something that Oscar was thinking about a lot. He'd come to decide that the country he had fought for in Vietnam wasn't really his country at all. Puerto Rico was his country, and the U.S. was his colonizer.
He became involved in founding an alternative school in Chicago focused on Puerto Rican history. They met in a basement of a church with no money and just about a dozen or so students.
And this is important because several of the people that we spoke to for this episode, including Oscar, told us that learning Puerto Rican history is what would eventually lead them to take up arms against the United States.
When they were school kids back in Puerto Rico, they said they didn't really learn Puerto Rican history. They'd only heard the narrative in which Puerto Rico was this happy, democratic commonwealth.
The surf pounds this Caribbean shoreline of what Christopher Columbus dubbed El Puerto Rico.
This is sound from a short documentary filmed by the U.S. government in 1955, and it gives you a sense of what the official story on Puerto Rico was like back then.
Yes, Puerto Rico has come a long way in a relatively short time, and its people are proud of their ability to achieve, in part, a successful economic pattern and a happy way of life.
They began to learn, however, that there's another side to Puerto Rican history. They learned about the gag law of 1948 that made it illegal to fly a Puerto Rican flag or to talk about independence on the island. They also learned about the Ponce Massacre, when police killed 19 civilians at a peaceful pro-independence march.
And they also learned about the independence activists who attacked Congress in 1954.
Police hurry to America's House of Representatives in Washington following an attack by three Puerto Ricans, including Rafael Miranda, who fired on the senators in the chamber. Fellow gunman Andres Condero and the woman member of the trio, Lolita Lebron, are hustled away from the menacing...
This story in particular captivated Oscar. For him, they weren't fanatics. They were Puerto Rican patriots.
He remembers this moment, the moment when everything came into focus for him. It was when he heard a recording of one of the people who attacked Congress, Lolita Lebron.
She was explaining, you know, she said, we did not come to the Congress of the United States to kill anyone. We came to give our lives for Puerto Rico. That was very, 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 very touching to hear this woman. And her voice had this rhythm. It's almost like when you listen to an automatic weapon, you know, the ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. And it was just like a haunting voice.
Y no vacilará Puerto Rico si necesario fuera a este último recurso
and,
de las nacionalidades.
It was a challenge, you know. If this woman was willing to give her life for Puerto Rico, you know, then why shouldn't I be able to do the same? Or is it not worthwhile to fight for the independence of Puerto Rico at all costs?
Coming up, what Oscar Lopez Rivera decides to do. So were you ever responsible for building or setting off a bomb? Stay with us. No te vayas.
Thank you. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. More information is available online at carnegie.org. And Fifth Generation Inc., maker of 80-proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, distilled from corn and naturally gluten-free. Recipes and more at titosvodka.com. Distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Marlon Bishop.
Today, the story of Oscar Lopez Rivera. When we left off, Oscar was asking himself, what can I do to advance the cause of Puerto Rican liberation?
And so he made a decision.
So were you a member of the FALN?
I have no problems admitting, you know, that yes, we were part of I was part of the FALN.
It's not known exactly when Oscar became part of Las Fuerzas Armadas de Liberación Nacional, or the Armed Forces of National Liberation. But the FALN first announced its existence to the world on October 26, 1974. It was the day before a major Puerto Rican political rally at Madison Square Garden.
A little before 3 a.m., the first bomb went off. It went off outside a bank in New York's financial district, tossing a car in the air and shattering office windows. A few minutes later, another bomb went off. And then another. And then two more.
Soon after, somebody called the Associated Press and told reporters to go to a phone booth on Broadway and 73rd Street. There, taped under the phone, was a communique.
It was 3 pages long. At the top of the first page was a logo, a 5-pointed star with block letters reading FALN that wouldn't be out of place on a 1970s movie poster. It read,
Communique number 1, October 26, 1974. Today, commando units of FALN attacked major Yankee corporations in New York City. It is these corporations which are responsible for the robbery and exploitation of third world countries in order to make greater profit and increase their capital. They are the ones which often decide who shall govern countries, who shall live, and who shall die.
By the way, that's an actor who we hired to read the communique, which goes on to mention Marx and a revolutionary people's army, and then it ends in all caps,
Long live free Puerto Rico! Long live the unity of all people in a struggle against imperialism. FALN Central Command.
Those bombings happened late at night and caused no injuries. And this kind of bombing wasn't too unusual in those days. In the early 1970s, a number of radical bombing groups appeared in the United States.
This was in the middle of the Cold War, and there were leftist insurgencies that were happening all over in Latin America, in Africa, in Asia. And in the U.S., a huge student protest movement had been simmering.
Journalist Brian Burrow wrote a book about the 1970s and radical violence titled Days of Rage.
The anti-war movement, the civil rights movement, generated a tremendous amount of passion among those willing to take the streets. But as 1969 turned to 70 to 71, those movements began to splinter. And among the people left behind, if you will, were those who felt these issues most keenly, the really hardcore.
Underground armed groups like the Weathermen and the Black Liberation Army appeared on the scene, and they were committed to going way farther than the protest groups.
You were going to have to, as they were always saying, quote, take things to the next level, which means violence, which meant bombings.
It was a time when bombs started going off all the time in American cities, from groups on the left and the right. Today, it might be front page news for a week if a bomb exploded in Manhattan or San Francisco. But in the 70s, says Brian, it would barely make the paper. He says there were over 1,900 domestic bombings, many very small, but bombings nonetheless, in 1972 alone.
If you judge it by its peers in the 1970s, the FALN was the most determined and no doubt the most, quote, successful of the radical underground bombing groups, in that they did more bombings than most of the groups, remained active longer. While some of these groups tend to lose their energy as time went on, the FALN never did.
How How the FALN came to be remains a mystery. There's a few theories, though. Some at the FBI thought they were formed or maybe trained or supported by Cuban intelligence, but that's far from being proven. The FALN are believed to have had two main cells, one in New York and one in Chicago.
The FBI believes Oscar was one of their leaders, although he's never admitted to that. Oscar wouldn't talk to us about any of his activities with the FALN. In fact, nobody in the group has ever discussed operations at all, with one exception we'll talk about in a bit. But some former members we talked to were willing to talk generally about the choice to take up arms.
Righteous indignation gets to you, you know, and sometimes drives you in a direction.
Carlos Alberto Torres is one of those members.
He was a close friend of Oscar's from Chicago and served 30 years in prison, also for seditious conspiracy. I spoke with Carlos in Oscar's old neighborhood of Humboldt Park, where he still lives today.
Armed struggle or the peaceful road is something that Gandhi grappled with in India. The founding fathers of the United States grappled with that idea, and they decided to take up arms.
When you think about, you know, the bombing campaigns of kind of skyscrapers and public buildings, what was kind of the idea strategically of what could be achieved?
Let me just start by saying this. Yeah. Open up any newspaper today, point at the article about Puerto Rico.
But there isn't.
Exactly, there's none. Yeah. And that's no different 40 years ago, probably even less. What you describe is, we described it as armed propaganda. It was a way of bringing the focus and attention to the issue of Puerto Rico in the United States.
Were you scared? I mean,
scared. You'd be insane not to be scared. You know, of course we were scared. My God. We knew the possibilities were, well, look, we're either going to win, we're either going to be killed, or we're going to end up in jail. And those are the options.
Oscar's brother, Jose Lopez, wasn't a member of the FALN. But he tried to explain to us this idea of armed propaganda that Carlos mentioned and why the FALN members felt it was so necessary.
You know, people don't understand, the U.S. Supreme Court in 1922 in Balzac versus the people of Puerto Rico stated Puerto Rico belongs to, but it's not a part of the United States. So when you have someone telling you you're a piece of property, and then to the world, oh, what a beautiful little island here that's the showcase of democracy. How do you get your message across? And I think sometimes people go through desperate ways, maybe inexcusable ways, to call attention to their situation.
Three people were killed in New York City today and more than 30 injured when a bomb went off in a crowded financial district in the middle of the lunch hour.
The next major bombing by the FALN happened a few months after the first one, in January of 1975. The bomb went off in Francis Tavern, a landmark restaurant in New York's financial district. In the end, four people were killed and about 60 injured.
Here's Brian Burrow, the journalist we heard from earlier.
The attack on Francis Tavern made clear that this was no accident. This was a bomb set in, you know, kind of a symbolic area, Wall Street, in a restaurant that was populated by white Wall Street men. It was an attack on capitalism, and it was intended to kill, and it did.
The entire neighborhood shook, said a resident.
Knocked me over, but I didn't get hurt. I'm just shook up, that's all. There's nothing the matter with me.
You consider yourself fortunate?
Oh, and how? And how?
And just like the last time, a communique was found taped to a phone booth.
Communique number 3, January 24th, 1975. We, FALN, take full responsibility for the bomb that exploded today at Francis Tavern, with reactionary corporate executives inside. We warn the North American government that to terrorize and kill our people would mean retaliation by us. This was not an empty warning.
The communique also said that the bombing was in retaliation for a different bomb that went off in Puerto Rico several weeks earlier and killed two independence activists. The communique claimed that the CIA ordered that bomb, though this has never been proven.
The Francis Tavern bombing would be the deadliest attack in the FALN's history. Of the over 70 bombs they would eventually claim responsibility for, only one other would result in a death, but the vast majority would cause no injuries.
Oscar Lopez Rivera has denied having any role in Francis Tavern or any knowledge about it beforehand.
So were you ever responsible for building or setting off a bomb?
Well, they said that I was the bomb builder, you know. If they had evidence to charge me with anything, they would have done that.
To this day, it remains unsolved who exactly set or built that bomb. In fact, there's never been any hard evidence proving Oscar built or set any specific bombs at all, but we'll get into his legal case later. Anyway, after Francis Tavern, catching the FALN became a top priority for the FBI.
It was truly the first truly clandestine terror organization that we confronted, and we had no clue as to how to approach this.
Rick Hahn was one of the FBI agents assigned to the case in New York.
They were very sophisticated, and we didn't realize it. And I think that's part of the problem that we had in identifying FALN members.
Rick says they would use espionage techniques, like so-called dry cleaning, in which they would take circuitous routes when traveling to figure out if they were being tailed. Or they might change appearances while traveling to a meeting.
They would engage in the use of dead drops, which is to say you place a note somewhere outside where it's accessible, but you don't actually meet with the person that's going to pick up that note. False hair items, reversible clothing, and professional makeup kits, that sort of thing.
As the FBI scrambled, the bombs continued to go off.
Communique number 4, April 2nd, 1975. The FALN takes responsibility for the bombings of Yankee corporations in New York.
Communique number 5, on Saturday, June 14th, 1975.
Communique number 6, October 27, 1975. We demand the immediate independence of
Communique number 7.
Armed commando units of the FALN take responsibility for the dynamite that made
since June of 1976. We have launched an offensive to dramatize the strangulation of the Puerto Rican people in the island, as well as
subjugation and exploitation of the Puerto Rican people.
Almost 2 years after their first bombs, the FBI still had no idea who the FALN were. And then, in the fall of 1976, they got a big lead. Here's Brian Burrow.
The FBI's break in the case came when a drug addict broke into someone's apartment in Chicago. And looking for money or drugs, he instead found a dynamite cord and some dynamite, which he then stole and attempted to sell. And when the Chicago police found it and then raided the apartment, they found a lot of FALN memorabilia and communiques clearly linking the dynamite to the group.
The FBI were able to link the apartment to two people, Carlos Alberto Torres, who we heard from before talking about armed propaganda, and Oscar Lopez Rivera. Carlos ended up being put on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. That very day, Oscar and Carlos, as well as Carlos's wife, Maria Aide Torres, and Oscar's girlfriend, Lucy Rodriguez, took another step and went underground.
And what going underground means, really, is that you try to avoid being arrested by living under false identities. Here's Carlos.
If I'm on the 10 most wanted list, of course, I'm not going to go look for an apartment and say I'm Carlos Alberto Torres. You know, I'm going to say I'm Juan Rivera or whatever. There is an aspect of it, and I've talked about it before, where you always live in a lie. You know, you're always, everything that surrounds you that you project is a lie because you are trying to avoid capture. It's something that you are willing to put up with because you see it as a necessary sacrifice in order to continue the struggle.
If you wanted to develop a false identity in those days, what you did was go to a cemetery and look for the names of infants who died around the time that you were born, because those names wouldn't have any ID in use. Then you'd go and apply for a birth certificate using that dead infant's name. And once you had that birth certificate, you could build up all kinds of other identification from there. Passports, driver's licenses, and so on.
But even with a false name, the FBI would be looking for Carlos. So he says he would do a kind of mental exercise where he'd try to put himself in the FBI's shoes.
And I knew that they were going to be looking for a Puerto Rican, and how would they see a Puerto Rican? And then how do I look different than that? That was just, you know, me thinking. I could have been totally delusional in that, but I think it worked a little bit.
While Oscar and the others lived underground, a massive FBI manhunt to find them was underway. Oscar's brother Jose says that their families were having their houses raided by the FBI on what felt like a daily basis.
One day, I have two daughters that were very, very young. They landed a helicopter on top of my house because they were trying to figure out where Oscar was at. And we became the natural target that we were hiding him.
Oscar and the others who were underground evaded arrest for years without getting caught. Meanwhile, during those same years, dozens of FALN bombs continued to go off in New York and Chicago, including several that caused injuries. In one, the bombing of the Mobil Oil building in New York, a man was killed before police could evacuate the building. Fast forward to the spring of 1980, Evanston, Illinois, 6 years after the first bombs.
One of the things the FALN did in order to fund their activities was rob banks and armored cars. And during one such operation, things went very wrong. According to the later court testimony, FALN members had parked a van on a suburban side street. They were waiting for an armored truck they planned to rob and were standing outside smoking. A woman was spying on them through a window, thought they looked suspicious, and called the police. When the police arrived, they found weapons and ended up arresting everyone in the van.
The FBI is talking today about the arrests of 11 suspected members of the Puerto Rican separatist group FALN. So far, no one in the group is talking, but the FBI says it has identified five of them through fingerprints. The arrests happened last night in a Chicago suburb, almost by accident.
The question is, what on earth were they doing in the well-to-do, respectable suburb of Evanston, Illinois, tree-lined and genteel? Home of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, no less, and not exactly the kind of place that alleged terrorist, one with a dangling false mustache, could in mid-afternoon jog back and forth around a van without being noticed.
Something strange about what they were doing this for. And it wasn't natural.
And nobody cooperates. No names, no nothing.
Ricardo Jimenez was one of the 11 people arrested that day. He was 23 years old at the time. The FALN had a plan for what to do if they were arrested. They would not cooperate whatsoever.
They couldn't identify us at all. Okay, they don't have the technology they have today. So then they called the FBI.
When the FBI arrived, they ID'd Carlos Alberto Torres, Maria Aide Lopez, and Lucy Rodriguez, three of the four who went underground in 1976.
Oscar wasn't with them that day. But a year later, police pulled over a car in a Chicago suburb. The driver was using an Oregon driver's license with the name Jose Ortiz. The police found a gun in the car and took the man into the police station for further questioning. They ran his prints and, to their surprise, discovered that they had just arrested Oscar Lopez Rivera, one of the most wanted men in the nation.
Coming up, the FALN on trial.
Mr. Jimenez, if I could, I would give you the death penalty without hesitation. But I'm going to make sure you never, never, never come out of prison.
Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Epstein Family Foundation in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tumana Memorial Fund, established to support NPR's international journalists, their coverage, and their commitment to providing the news of the world to audiences back home. And Heather Sturt-Haga and Paul G. Haga, working to ensure wildlife and wildlands thrive in modern Africa. Learn more at awf.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Marlon Bishop. When we left off, 11 FALN members had just been arrested. Soon after, Oscar Lopez Rivera was also arrested. There were two federal trials, one for Oscar, one for everyone else. But in both, the FBI had the same problem.
Trying to relate specific bombings to specific individuals was virtually impossible.
That's former FBI agent Rick Hahn.
Somebody goes and builds a bomb and puts it down, unless they've been careless and left a fingerprint, or these days, DNA, and of course we didn't have DNA in those days, linking it to a specific individual is a very difficult thing.
The FBI were only able to link one of the FALN prisoners, Marie Aide Torres, to a specific bomb. For all the others, including Oscar, there was no hard evidence proving they ever touched a bomb. So they tried them for something called seditious conspiracy.
It is to attempt to overthrow by force the power of the United States government.
It's a rare charge reserved for violence committed in the name of politics or ideology. According to legal scholars, for much of the 20th century, it was mostly used against Puerto Rican nationalists. Seditious conspiracy carries much harsher penalties than regular conspiracy, 20 years per count instead of 5.
Specifically, they were accused of a conspiracy to commit 28 bombings in the Chicago area. And in their defense, the accused FALN members did, well, nothing. They didn't challenge any of the charges. And it was all part of a strategy.
Their idea was to use the trial to send a message to the world. They said, look, Puerto Rico is a colony of the United States. And according to the United Nations, colonialism is a violation of human rights. Therefore, their interpretation went, they had the legal right to fight against it, including by force. And
people who are fighting colonialism are not to be criminalized by the colonizers.
Jan Sussler is the lawyer for Oscar and the other FALN defendants.
When they went to trial, these young men and women, they said, look, we've studied international law. We know Puerto Rico is a colony, and we know that international law prohibits the United States from trying us as criminals. And therefore, we can't participate because this trial is illegal.
They demanded to be seen by an international tribunal, but they were denied.
We were never in the courtroom. The jurors never saw us. Never, never, never.
Ricardo Jimenez was one of the accused FALN members. We heard him before talking about his arrest.
They found us guilty. When they sentenced me, I remember Judge McMillan saying, Mr. Jimenez, if I could, I would give you the death penalty without hesitation. But I'm going to make sure you never, never, never come out of prison.
The judge banged the gavel.
90 consecutive years, consecutive to your state term. Boom, get him out of here, get him out of here. And they threw me out of the courtroom. I told him, I said, you can give me 100, 200, 500 years, but you're never going to stop the movement for Puerto Rican independence and the fact that Puerto Rico is a colony of the United States.
All of the defendants ended up with long sentences. Oscar got 55 years. Others were handed 70 or 90.
And the reason the government was able to convict Oscar at all was because of a guy named Freddy Mendez. Freddy was a new FALN recruit. He was arrested with the larger group, and facing a near-life sentence, he decided to testify against Oscar in hopes of getting his sentence reduced. Freddy said that Oscar was a leader of the FALN, that he directed various operations and taught him how to make bombs. After his testimony, Freddie was put in the Witness Protection Program for his safety, where he's believed to still be today, living under a different name.
After the trials, the FALN began to dissolve. There were a few more bombings between 1981 and 83, and there were a few more arrests. But essentially, it was over. 7 years after the first bombs, the FALN's offensive against the United States government had been put down.
In 1988, after spending 7 years in prison, Oscar was accused of trying to escape. And as punishment, his sentence was extended to 70 years. He was also then transferred to a higher security facility, where he was alone in his cell on lockdown for 23 hours a day for 12 years.
In the years that followed, a movement emerged in the Puerto Rican community asking for a presidential pardon for the FALN members in prison. The movement argued that they were not terrorists, but in fact, political prisoners. Here's their lawyer, Jan Sussler.
They were sentenced not because of what they did, but because of who they were politically. Seditious conspiracy is really a thought crime. It's agreeing to be part of challenging the United States government.
But opponents say that the thought crime argument is misleading. They point out that the conspiracy conviction was connected to 28 actual bombings in the Chicago area. Nevertheless, the push for their freedom, it worked.
But first, President Clinton issued his clemency order.
In 1999, President Bill Clinton offered to commute the sentences of 14 of the prisoners. Here's one of the prisoners, Ricardo, on Meet the Press shortly after his release.
Of what was going on.
You call yourself a freedom fighter. Will you continue to use any means necessary to bring about, in your mind, the decolonization of Puerto Rico?
I definitely will not be using any violence whatsoever.
The commutations were offered to all but two.
Oscar was also offered a commutation, but he refused. One of the reasons he gave is that he wouldn't leave unless all of his comrades were freed.
I have never left anyone behind. Never, never. I don't care what was in Vietnam, whatever it was, out in the streets of Chicago. Never. And two of my co-defendants were left out. And I could not.
These last two were eventually released in 2009 and 2010. Oscar remained in prison, but his supporters never gave up.
In 2016, activists started ramping up their campaign in earnest to ask President Obama to release Oscar. They put together a heavyweight roster of supporters: Bernie Sanders, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, stars like Ricky Martin and Ruben Blades.
Last year, we visited Chicago to get a sense of why people were so passionate about his case. And while we were there, I stopped by an event supporting Oscar, held at a community center. There, I met lots of Oscar fans, like Omar Torres.
Basically, every country has a freedom fighter.
Oscar, he says, is Puerto Rico's freedom fighter, just as South Africa had Nelson Mandela.
I think Nelson Mandela is a really good way of looking at it because he was part of an armed struggle. And obviously, you know, it's hard for people to identify the movement of the liberation of Puerto Rico in the same level as apartheid, for example. But the reality is that it is a form of colonialism, and he was rebelling against that.
But as you might expect, there are many who don't see Oscar Lopez Rivera as any kind of hero.
I would love to ask people who support his release and say, if not a terrorist, what has Oscar Lopez done to help the Puerto Rican people?
Joe Connor was just 9 years old when his dad, a 33-year-old banker at J.P. Morgan, was killed in the Francis Tavern bombing.
I'm hearing he's a freedom fighter. He's done all these things. He's not violent. But what did he do if not being a terrorist? There's no answer to it because he was a terrorist. If they could point to something, but there is nothing. That's what he did.
Joe's life has been uniquely touched by terrorism. In a stroke of terrible luck, he also lost his cousin years later in 9/11. But when it comes to Oscar, Joe says he doesn't want to hold a grudge.
I'm a Catholic. I think he probably is too. I believe in forgiveness. I believe in redemption. But people are only worthy of forgiveness if they look for forgiveness.
Joe and his family went to Oscar's parole hearing in 2011. And he said they were prepared to recommend to the parole board that they release Oscar.
I mean, we sat in that little room in the prison in Terre Haute waiting for him to say, you know what? I was a young man. I was wrong. It's terrible what I did to all these people. But we didn't get that. It could have all ended that day for him and for us. But it didn't, because he wouldn't own up to what he did. How can we forgive that?
To this day, nobody has ever been convicted for the Francis Tavern bombing. And as we mentioned before, Oscar has denied having anything to do with it. Rick Hahn, the former FBI agent who pursued the FALN, says that regardless, at 74 years old, Oscar no longer presents a danger to the United States today. But he doesn't think he deserves freedom either.
Mr. Lopez, and let me read you a quote here. I, as an individual, would never set out to inflict pain and suffering on any person not identified as my enemy, unquote. But who in the world defines who his enemy is? The answer is he does, in some fictional world in his head where he is some romantic freedom fighter, when in fact he is just a modern terrorist.
If Oscar has a heavy conscience about the five people who died in bombings claimed by the FALN, he hasn't shown it.
I can seriously put my head on that pillow every night and feel comfortable with myself. And I know that if ever I walk out of prison, I will walk with my head high.
He's insisted over the years that he doesn't have blood on his hands. We asked him what he thinks about the term that Joe Connor used about him, calling him a terrorist, and this is what he said.
One of the things that I learned early in the struggle was the power to define. Well, if I'm defined as a terrorist, I am looking at who is defining me. Terrorism for me, I don't have in my heart, I don't have in my conscience anything that deals with terrorism.
We asked some of the other former FALN members what they think about the people who died in their bombings. And for the most part, the answers we got were kind of evasive. Although he insists he wasn't involved in any of the fatal bombings, Carlos Alberto Torres had this to say.
Of course, I don't consider it a victory if people are hurt or get killed. I don't consider it something to celebrate. But we don't always control everything that occurs.
Carlos spent most of his adult life in prison for decisions he made as a young man. But like all the other former members we interviewed, he says he wouldn't take any of it back.
My only regret, or one of my regrets, is that we weren't successful. But Puerto Rico will be an independent country. That is my dream. And it will be my dream until I die if it is an independent country by then, but it will be somebody else's dream.
In January of 2017, just a few days before leaving office, President Barack Obama offered to commute Oscar Lopez Rivera's sentence. His release date would be set for May of 2017. Up to the last moment, his supporters didn't think it was going to happen. Over 100,000 people had signed a petition asking for his release. But the White House hadn't given any indications of what they planned to do. The very day the commutation was announced, we checked in with Joe Connor, the man whose father was killed at Francis Tavern.
I always suspected this was going to happen. Look, he's going to have to face a higher authority than Barack Obama. He's going to meet his maker, and I hope that he's prepared at that point to defend what he's done in his life.
When we interviewed Oscar, back when he was still in prison, we asked him what he would do with himself if he got out.
I would love to spend time with my daughter, my granddaughter, my family, my friends, you know, just enjoy a little bit of life, you know.
And when you say enjoy a little bit of life, like, what's that image do you have? I mean, es un cafecito, es una cerveza, is it?
No, no alcohol for me. It would be having some coffee, being able to dialogue, be able to share ideas with people. You know, those are the things that I really look forward to, you know, listening to people, you know, see what's in their mind.
History has a curious way of being invisible while you're living in it. We don't know if Oscar will go down as an underdog hero who fought for a just cause, or a violent fanatic, or if he'll simply be forgotten.
Whatever history decides, he's had decades in prison to reckon with his life and his choices. And he doesn't seem to have any regrets either.
I made a decision, and it was a decision dealing with finding meaning and purpose in life, you know, and not living a life just to exist, you know. And the struggle for me is where I found meaning in life. And I knew that would keep me strong. And it has.
That purpose in his life was Puerto Rico, or at least an idealized vision of it.
He found an obsession worth living and dying for, an independence that the island wasn't even sure it wanted.
And now Oscar will return there, but not to the independent Puerto Rico he always dreamed of.
That one, a lifetime of fighting later, remains just a dream.
We first aired this episode in January of 2017. A few months later, in May, Oscar was released from federal custody. And after leaving prison, he moved to Puerto Rico, where he lives today.
I live with my daughter, who has been very generous with me, keeping me in her house.
We called him to find out what's happened since his release. He says that most of his time is devoted to community work on the island.
It's not what I expected. I expected for conditions to be bad, but not as bad as they are right now, especially after the hurricane.
Oscar has occasionally made appearances on the mainland as a speaker or at rallies. Most controversially, he was selected to be honored as a National Freedom Hero by New York's Puerto Rican Day Parade last summer. That led to a drama in which politicians and corporations threatened to withdraw support for the parade. In the end, Oscar appeared in the parade, but without receiving the honor. He says he continues to struggle, now peacefully, for the cause of Puerto Rican independence.
I'm not advocating for any kind of violence. I'm not advocating for anything other than to wage a struggle of love for Puerto Rico.
I reported for this episode along with Marlon Bishop, who produced it. It was edited by Nadia Raymond. It was sound designed by Noam Hassenfeld. The Latino USA team includes Miguel Macias, Sofia Paliza Carr, Antonia Cerejido, Andres Caballero, Maggie Freeling, and Janice Yamoka, with help from Fernanda Chavarri. Our engineers are Ginny Montalvo and Stephanie LeBeau. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholtz. Our fellows are Virginia Lora and Jesse Alejandro Cottrell. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. And if you like the music that you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media, and I will see you there. Hasta la próxima. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. Winecoat Foundation and WK Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, supporting the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, and encouraging the U.S. Hispanic community to learn more about the benefits of getting screened for the early detection of cancer. More at noesperes.org. And FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org. This is NPR.